podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to this week's FYP podcast. Plenty to talk about after Saturday's magnificent win at Old Trafford and the news that emerged earlier today about yet another injury, this time for Eberiche Eze. We also answer listeners' questions, nominate this week's candidates in 3-2-1 and look ahead to Saturday's late kickoff against Forest. I'm your host Jack Pearce and joining me this week are a man likely to be pleased to have timed his first week off of the season by missing the joys of analysing a 0-0 at home and being dumped out of the cup last week. It's Joe Walker. Joe, how are you?
I'm very good, particularly after that weekend's result. Given the, I thought we could telegraph how the next few weeks are going to play out with the depth being such a problem, and has now increased that problem. But there's nothing like a win. And 3 points, a surprise 3 points on the board just to lift the spirits again.
It will do it. And funnily enough, after a few days, I think the Everton and Spurs games have both sold out. So nothing wow. Like an away win at United to get the ticket sales going as well. I presume you're happier to be talking about this trip to Old Trafford than you were the other one. So look forward to hearing your thoughts on that one. Joe and I are joined this week by a man making, I think, his first midweek pod appearance of the season. We're delighted that The Athletic's Dom Fifield has joined us. Dom, lovely to have you join us this week. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, all is good. Great win at Old Trafford, tempered in true Palace style by everything that's happened since.
Yes, quite. Typical Palace, as JD would say, I'm sure. Dom, before we get into talking Palace, can I ask you, can England retain the 50-over World Cup?
Yeah, although I'd like to see them sort of attempt to bat through 50 overs, really. I mean, given it is a 50-over competition, but yeah, it would be a fun watch, starting on Thursday, isn't it, against New Zealand. So, yes. Fingers crossed.
The repeat of the final to kick off the tournament, which I think a lot of these global tournaments are now trying to do to kind of revisit past glories. But, yeah, hopefully not as stressful as that Sunday at Lords. But anyway, well, let's get back to Palace. This season, we are sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Green King Sport venues are showing every televised Palace fixture over the course of the season. So if you're not able to get to Selhurst on Saturday for our next league match against Nottingham Forest, instead of turning to the internet for a dodgy stream, why not get your mates together and get down to your local Green King pub and get closer to the action? Green King Sport have recently launched the Green King Sport Instagram page, which will be home to fan content, deals and competitions throughout the season. Drop them a follow and you won't just be the first to know all about this. You'll also be helping out the FYP podcast. We'll include a link in the show notes. We'd also like to thank our patrons whose continued support is much appreciated. If you're not currently a patron and would like to support us and receive, among other things, access to post-match podcasts with the likes of Adam Sells and Mr. Fifield, as well as ad-free versions of all FYP episodes, please visit patreon.com/FYP podcast to join. Speaking of Selsey, it prompts our first question of the week from Julian Chenery, he of both Oxted and Dubai, who asks, how many miles has Selsey driven this week? I understand he got the train to the League Cup match, and as patrons will know only too well, he drove on Saturday. So in view of Palace matches, at least, I'd estimate just shy of 600 miles for that round trip. To all Palace fans that made one of the trips, let alone both, to the Northwest, kudos to every one of you. A fantastic effort, rightly applauded by the team. At great scenes at the end of Saturday's match. Also, special thanks to Edmund Brack, who hosted the post-match pod on Saturday. Very nicely done, and I'm sure appreciated by Rob Sutherland, who spent his weekend watching a different type of football in sunny California. Right, onwards, and I'll throw straight to you, Dom, to use an NFL term. after Tuesday's League Cup defeat, Dom, did you anticipate the performance, let alone the result on Saturday?
It was always going to be a different type of performance from Palace because the lineup was stronger. I mean, bringing in, you know, arguably the best centre half pairing we've had since, I don't know, Eric Young and Andy Thorne or something like that was going to add a bit of steel to it all. I mean, obviously, that it was just as limited in forward areas as it had been in midweek, but it just had there was a bit more resolve to it all, and I think a lot of those players were keen to make amends almost for the rather anemic display on the Tuesday night previously. You know, I'm not blaming them for the performance in the League Cup, but it was just one of those days, and the resources are so limited. But and with United as well, I mean, you look at them and they're so inconsistent. You know, what was to say that they were going to suddenly run out 2 or 3 nil winners again? They're more than capable, as they've proved all season, of just following up, you know, a relatively decent performance with an absolutely abject one. So you shouldn't be that surprised. But it was just so timely. It was just such a fantastically resilient, committed, disciplined display from Hodgson's team, knowing that they had limited firepower, that they weren't going to be able to open up United. They just had to sit there deep. They accepted they weren't going to have very much of the ball. They allowed United to have it in areas where Mark Goldridge was getting very excited because they were monopolising it, but they were doing absolutely no damage whatsoever. And to win it with a goal of that splendour was just, well, just wonderful, to be honest. And a brilliant, brilliant result. Continuing a brilliant spell of results for Roy Hodgson up at Old Trafford. And when you look at what's to come and the mounting injury list, such a timely victory.
Beautifully segue to my question for Joe, which is, Joe, Roy became the first visiting manager to remain 5 matches in a row unbeaten Old Trafford in the Premier League era. That run does include 3 Palace wins, so it's not a case of kind of grinding out nil-nils, which are amongst those results. I think is Watford, yeah. One was a nil-nil.
Which might be the most extraordinary of the 5, I'd argue.
I was going to say that to get any points in that Watford spell did actually surprise me. But anyway, that run is certainly not to be sniffed at, and the fact that he's the first to do it kind of says it all. But, you know, Dom's just summed up the performance beautifully. But for you, what did Roy and the team do so well on Saturday?
Well, I think it was... There were some chances and there were some opportunities that, you know, I mean, I actually thought one of probably the closest we came, both chances involved, or they came, both involved Tyrick Mitchell, the goal line clearance, but then also any heavier contact might have been an own goal at the death there. But in terms of just limiting their play, let them have the ball. I think we're quite comfy as a team, especially under Hodgson. We'll let a bigger side have the ball. But what's quite pertinent was that actually how... it's interesting, I guess, depends on what side of the fence you're on. There was a video that went viral, created by Manchester United fans, I think, of Marcus Rashford's sort of non-creativity across the game. But you could also look at it as Joel Ward just really kind of putting in a really... energetic performance to ensure that, you know, his chances and his kind of the openings were a bit limited as he cut inside, which as he's wont to do as a kind of right-footed, you know, striker by trade really, but likes to come inside. I back us as a defensive team when the spine is fit, particularly at the back. Dom's already touched on the centre halves who are both just incredible, I think, and for our standard. And then having a Decore, even a Will Hughes, who isn't your starter with everybody fit, but I think is someone that is quite happy to roll in the mud for an occasion like Saturday and do what's asked. That as a unit, it's always nice. It's not the biggest surprise when we sneak points playing like that, because I think many more teams will struggle to break that through if that's the way we want to approach a game.
That base you talk about, you know, when the teams were announced, just reminded of that quality of that, the goalkeeper, the 2 centre halves with Decore, who did start in the League Cup match, but you know, I think with Gay and Anderson behind him is an even better player. And then you are just, as Andy Bell referenced last week when we were previewing the game, set pieces needed to be exploited, and it was a set piece that the goal did come from. And we'll move on to the Joe I love him, because I think it's required. I think that performance and just the way he started the season does require us to focus on him specifically. Dom, as a Palace aficionado, where does Joachim Andersen rank among the best Palace centre-halves that you've seen play for the club?
Oh, he's right up there. He's his quality, his sort of silky quality to his play. His distribution is remarkable at times. Those diagonal passes, which we've referenced many a time on this podcast, booming across field to a, you know, to a winger or an overlapping fullback. He just oozes class and quality and authority. And the partnership with Gay in particular, they just struck it off really from the outset when they were thrust together under Vieira in the summer of 21. And it's just, I mean, it is amazing to see. I mean, there will be a lot of Premier League teams looking at Joachim Andersen thinking, why weren't we in the market to sign him from Lyon? Likewise with Gay, to be honest. I mean, I think the pair of them, I thought Gay was outstanding against Fulham. Mm-hmm. Absolutely brilliant against Fulham. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the eye is drawn to his performances. Maybe that's just, I don't know, maybe that's me being biased and an England fan as well and wanting him to do well in the England setup. But Joachim Andersen's an experienced international defender. And I'm sure he's bringing the best out of Mark Gay's game as well. I didn't think he had that in his locker, I have to say. I mean, it was quite a remarkable goal. It had a few pundits going, there must have been a wicked deflection on it for it to have gone past Onana in the way it did. But it was just struck so sweetly, having improvised to sort of twist and contort his body in a position where he could make a sufficient connection and you know, saw it past the keeper. But yeah, absolutely stunning and certainly one of the best. And you know, I used to love watching the aforementioned Andy Thorne and Eric Young and Chris Coleman back in the day, but I'm not sure we ever had this level of classiness to our centre-half pairings. They were sort of a bit more strong-arm, let's put it.
He is classy. I hadn't appreciated until maybe seeing it for the third or fourth time. The whipped-in cross that led to Mark Gay's chance, which I think preceded the goal, was Joachim Andersen whipping that in. I mean, that's one of the best crosses you're going to get across the Premier League weekend, and that's our centre-half knocking the ball into our other centre-half. I think technically...
Playing was a 10 on Saturday,
He was. We did actually have some questions as to whether he should be moved up the pitch to kind of fill the gaps that are appearing elsewhere in the 11. But yeah, technically speaking, that goal was quite something else. Joe, can you think of many better goals scored by a centre-half in a Palace shirt?
I had a moment of thinking about this, and I was drawn to a Jose Font goal at Stoke City, probably 2008, 2009, around that period. If I'm remembering right, a sort of badly cleared corner, chested and hit on the volley on the outside of the area. But, and obviously a player that's gone on to do some excellent things, but technique-wise, it has to rank as one of the best we've seen from a centre-half. Usually your classic centre-half goals are huge, long-distance strikes that they've absolutely smashed. I can think of a couple of examples that might
Paddy McCarthy
up.
At Derby.
Quite.
That type of, net buster, that type of, yes. That type of hit.
Yeah, whereas I think Saturday's goal, technique-wise, it almost was placed as well. It's with power, but it's gone exactly where he's meant it to go. It's not a wild swing. Yeah. I think a lot of our forward players would be very happy with that technique and how that's panned out.
Yeah, it was quite something. I did ask you both before recording to have a bit of a think as to goals you know. Joe, you just referenced Jose Font, which is a goal I do recall, but haven't seen it probably since the very weekend that he scored that goal. Dom, any that you want to kind of bring to the table?
Well, McCarthy was mentioned. I'll be honest. I put this question to my brother, who has a better memory for this era, for the sort of, I don't know, probably from the mid 2000s through to the Premier League era. And he mentioned McCarthy at Derby. I my personal favourites were, and they're very contrasting. I'm not sure they certainly don't have the technique that Joe's mentioned there with Joachim Andersen. But I'll always go back to Chris Coleman's meatball header at West Ham.
Yes.
Brilliant. And I just love that expression. I don't know what it means. Meatball header. What does that mean?
Snapped on. That was top of my list. Meatball header. The third of four goals at the Hawthorns in the championship.
Yeah,
Four one. I think it was. I think we were 1-0 down at half time and we cleaned the floor with them in the second half.
Has that term ever been used since, to anyone's knowledge?
Why would it? I mean, it's just,
yeah.
Maybe used in Italy all the time. God knows.
I think Dom and I, we talked about this previously. I did look long and hard for the audio. The YouTube version of the 93-94 season review has been removed, I presume, for reasons, whatever the license.
I have it on VHS here next to me.
We're going to have to play it and just record the audio. We've got to do it. I think we're just going to have to nick that audio and insert it into random pods throughout the rest of the season. But meatball header, Chris Coleman, 93. Another head, Dom, I'll come back to you for any more that you have, but another header that I had was Scott Dann, 2016, the equaliser with the last touch of the ball against Bournemouth, similar kind of... angle to it where he nods it in and guides it into the bottom corner, and I think that earned us a point against Bournemouth in early 2016.
He felt like a foot above everybody else in the pen from the kind of tussle in that duel.
He dragged a point for us when I don't think we really deserved it in that game, from what I recall. But that Chris Coleman and Scott Dann kind of diagonal header into the opposing bottom corner, the two that sprung to mind. Dom, any more from the Fifield WhatsApp chat?
I mean, there were. Well, this one was, Jim Cannon will have scored goals that haven't been caught on VHS even, and there will be some brilliant ones in there, because he had a mean, I think it was his left peg, wasn't it? It was particularly strong. But Gordon Petrich at Sheffield United, but it's another one of Joe's sort of smashing it in from distance, isn't it? I mean, there was a context to that, though, because it was in the middle of that weird 10-match unbeaten run that we had whilst in administration and losing two or three players every single week ahead of the transfer window. And he smashed one in at Sheffield, at Bramall Lane from a ridiculous and inconceivably long way out. And then we conceded with the last kick on the game and an equaliser and a 1-1 draw. And then apparently went into the dressing room afterwards and was like, come on, guys, we will make the playoffs. We will make the playoffs. It's like, no, we won't.
We don't want to. Gordon Petridge's only goal in a Palace shirt, that one. So one to remember for Gordon Petridge. Nice. That was JD's nominee for this too. But listener, if any has been to your mind that we've not mentioned, then do feel free to let us know, and we'll maybe highlight them as Joachim Andersen adds to his tally throughout the season. That's two now for him, which exceeds his one, which he scored last season. So, not quite sure. Does that place him second behind Odson Edouard in terms of our league goal scorers? I think it might. I think everyone else might be on one so far. So, here's to many more from Joa. Just in terms of Andersen, the clever people at whoscored.com currently rate that Joachim Andersen is one of the two best performing centre-halves across Europe's top five leagues, with an average rating of 7.6 from the first seven games. This was pointed out to me by Jerry of the Glad All Over San Francisco group. So shout out to him and all that no doubt enjoyed Saturday's win at the Pig and Whistle. Right, that's the positive done. Let's quickly touch on the more negative side of things as we end part one. News broke this morning that Eberechi Eze will be unavailable for around 6 weeks due to a hamstring injury. Dom, about as bad a piece of news injury-wise that we could get right now.
Yeah, absolute nightmare, to be honest. I mean, I suppose we have to caveat it that they will be assessing him now, and 6 weeks might not be accurate. It might not be. I mean, I suspect it's a safe assumption. It'll take him through to the November international break. It's dreadful timing for him because of the England setup, and he'd have wanted to play in the forthcoming games that they've got this month. But it's awful for Palace. I mean, I know people have been whinging a bit about how he's not being as effective possibly, and he should be, I don't know, keeping things simpler possibly in some of his play. The reality is he is carrying that forward line. I know Odson Edouard's got goals and also a hamstring injury, but he has got goals this season. But Eze is the player that other opposition teams are frightened of. They're the ones, they're doubling up on him, and which is freeing up space for other people. And maybe that's a reason that we're now getting crosses into the box for Odson Edouard to score. We have been. That has now gone. So you've now got a situation where Roy Hodgson has literally got no creative attacking talent to play either centrally or even in wide areas, and certainly no one of experience out wide. I mean, I'm not going to put IU in that bracket. Rakitić and Ebioe are too young to be relied upon at this stage in their careers. So it is desperately, desperately bad news for Palace. And it's, look, Palace are ninth in the table as we sit here, and they've actually had a really good start to the season. They've just won at Old Trafford. We should all be really satisfied with the way things have been going. But if he's out for 6 weeks and we've got a situation where Franca is going to have to get eased in gently, where Elise has had a little setback, so there's obviously a bit of a wariness there about the hamstring problem, where Odson Edouard's now carrying a hamstring issue of his own and presumably won't be risked ahead of this international break. And we've got games against Forest, opportunity in normal circumstances. I look at that Forest game now. Who's going to create a chance in that match for us? That's going to be harder than it was against Fulham. And that's ridiculous, because Forest are there for the taking. In a normal situation, we'd look at that game and think, well, Alicia will run rings down that side. Eze will be brilliant in the middle. Franca might cause them problems. Edouard scoring goals. We're laughing here. We don't have any of that. We don't even have Jefferson Lerma being energetic and dynamic in midfield. We're relying upon the most creative player in this side may well be Will Hughes. I mean, it's all Joachim Andersen from centre half, and it's a desperate situation. And I'm not going to, I don't want to sort of echo what has become a very common complaint that Selzy has aired, but he's spot on. The squad is too thin. The squad is too thin to expect to compete properly in the Premier League. But maybe mid-table is what the aspiration is, in which case we're fine because we're ninth at the moment and we'll probably be 13th when the players return from injury. It's so frustrating, though. It's so frustrating.
It does feel like the straw that broke the camel's back, in that we really couldn't afford an injury to anyone else, but specifically Ebs is just really difficult to take, isn't it?
I'm not being funny, Jack, but every year around this time, there are muscular injuries. And we knew the squad that we were going into the season with, and we knew that a lot of them were carrying injuries from last season, or vulnerability as well, fragility. You can throw Henderson in there as well, with what happened to him at Forest in the second half of last season, what's happened again. I think we're... it sounds ridiculous. I'm not going to jump on the bandwagon. I'm not going to join in the sort of calls for massive change at the club. Although I would say that the clarity that I call for at the start of the summer is, I think those arguments are still valid now. I'd like to know what is happening with the ambition and what is the strategy. But anyway, that's by the by. We knew this was going to happen, and it has happened. It shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody, and it'll be that means our season will be hamstrung, unfortunately.
Well, nicely played. But the sequence of hamstring injuries in particular is just so frustrating. And as you say, it's a type of injury that has to be treated with the utmost respect. You're not going to rush a player back to see how they might do, because you'll have a situation with more players, as has been the case with Michael Elise. We'll come on to maybe questions about some of those players who may well feature a little bit more in part two. But Joe, we'll touch on the Forest game later on as well. But I do wonder whether this injury will require Roy to alter the shape of the team, and perhaps just given the players available, given that we have a predominance of, you know, Premier League capable centre halves at least, wonder whether a change of system may be seen on Saturday in the adopting of either a 3 or a 5 at the back, whichever way you want to see it. What are your thoughts on that, or would you persist with the formation that has been set, even though the players to fill it perhaps aren't there? Well, there's no perhaps about it; they're not there.
Yes, yeah, I think you'd have to consider it, and maybe there was only so much to learn from the cup visit to Old Trafford in terms of, you know, things that we could apply to the league side. But I think one of them is or just the lack of having to change things around. There was that attempt to go to a five at the back. Some of it was more flexible than I think the commentary suggested. But, I mean, look, if everyone's fit, Eze would be replaced by Franca. And if it wasn't Franca, then it'd perhaps be Nairik Ahamada. But we've got none of them. So
he's another one. But yes. I mean, what an opportunity this would be for him. Yeah, he would be getting Premier League minutes that he's not yet had.
So then you start, it really is improvisation rather than kind of logical alternatives. I've seen some of the suggestions I've been reading through today. Are you centrally? I guess it's not something we haven't seen, but one of the more prominent opinions and ideas I've seen is putting Gyro further afield, which I just think is mad to think about a month ago, 2 months ago. And we'll get to
Gyro. We have plenty of questions about Gyro.
And just to echo some of Dom's thoughts there, I think we knew that problems would come along the way. I think the lack of depth, even bringing on Ebbs in the second half at Old Trafford in the lead, in the cup ties, is an example of when you haven't got the alternatives to bring on, you are just draining those that you do have there. If you are pushing them further and closer to their brinks, particularly with an injury like with a hamstring. So the injuries are more likely to happen. It's not unlucky that we have a small squad and a high injury list. I think we're now officially the highest injury list in the Premier League. But I think they come one and hand in hand, because you're asking those players that you do have to do a lot more often with less rest. And it's just there is a couple of difficult games coming up that I think if you're trying to find positives and go, well, maybe we wouldn't have done so well in the games coming up against Newcastle and Spurs, but Forest would be a game you'd be looking at this weekend thinking this is a bit of us, and I'm really worried about it now.
Look at the games in November though, lads. Yeah. I mean,
brutal.
I mean, but that's our opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Burnley, Everton, Luton, West Ham, Bournemouth in the beginning of December. And that's where we establish ourselves in the Premier League, essentially.
Yeah.
Before the games get horrible. I mean, there isn't a run this season like there was that poor Patrick Vieira had to endure last year in terms of the difficulty of the fixtures. But the matches, from the 9th of December are pretty horrific all the way through to the game against Sheffield United at the end of January. I mean, it's not an easy month.
And there's AFCON in January as well.
And there's AFCON then, exactly. So it really is a case that you need to exploit those matches in November, which presumably means that you don't risk someone. Now, if Franca, for example, had been training, with the first team, you wouldn't necessarily chuck him in from the start against Forest. If Lerma's approaching fitness now, you'd probably wait until after the international window. So not least, so that he doesn't go and travel. I don't know whether they've got a game or two games in this window, but he probably would want him to stick about and just continue the rehab and rebuilding up his strength. But it's untimely. It's really, really untimely. That's the problem. And dispiriting. But, it's a common complaint, and it goes back to what Selzy's been banging on about all season. There were opportunities possibly to bring in free transfers in the summer, to bulk up the squad, have more options there available to Roy Hodgson. And they weren't taken. Other than Jefferson Lerma. They may be very, very, very clear reasons why that didn't happen. We may want to keep the wage bill completely under control. We may want to position ourselves financially so that ahead of the stadium redevelopment, I don't know what it is because we're not told what it is. Yeah. But it's without that knowledge, it's pretty frustrating.
Not to feed the rumours that Andy Bell wanted to maybe get moving last week, but I guess Andros Townsend might be keeping his phone even closer to him this week than he has in previous weeks, but let's not go down that road.
The thing about that is, I mean, I did ask about this. I did wonder whether there were free transfer options, but the reality is any free transfer that comes in now that hasn't done a pre-season somewhere properly, that hasn't been playing for the last 2-3 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, he's not going to hit the ground running, and it's probably going to take a month to get up to speed, in which case, at which point you may have some of these players back, in which case they're not going to get into the team. So why would you necessarily pay the money to come and do it? So it's really tricky, but it's a legacy of the transfer window and the inaction of that, or the relative inaction of that.
I will end the part on just a reference to a prior free transfer who on this date in 2005 scored two goals at Loftus Road. So we are happy Marco Reich day, everyone. Don, was he on trial when he scored those two goals and then got his contract, or had he just got his contract?
I'm not sure you can play in a... Can you play in a competitive game when you're just on trial?
I feel like it was a one-to-three-month deal or something like that. Scored in the cup against Coventry at home, maybe in the cup.
That rings a bell.
Gets the QPR start, scores not long after, and
scores two.
Gets a longer deal and then doesn't score again, I don't think.
No, he certainly showed his worth before he got the longer contract. Anyway, sad way to end the pod. To end the part, but. As Dom says, we do have a Victory United to celebrate. It's just tempered with that very, very unfortunate news regarding Abrich Eze, but hopefully back sooner rather than the 6 weeks that's been indicated. But I guess that gives us something to talk about in the next few weeks. Thank you, guys. That's the end of part one. Part two, we'll be taking your questions. Welcome back to this week's FYP podcast, sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Before we get stuck into questions, another shout out for the Palace for Life Marathon March, which is a week on Saturday. So Saturday the 14th of October, the FYP team would love your donation. So please consider donating what you can to the team. We'll include the link in the show notes and we'll be plugging the link between now and the big day. Anyone that is doing that as well that might be listening, good luck. Hope your training is going well. Right, on to listeners' questions. And I have written here, before the Ebbs news broke, decidedly more upbeat than last week's questions. But we did have a couple of late submissions, which I think we have covered with our chat about Ebbs in the previous part. But I will start by asking you both. Bloke Ocean asks, crisis, what crisis? Would anyone swap the cup result for the 3 points in the league? Just a quick one on this. I think there was some chat prior to the league cup match that people would have preferred the League Cup win over a league win if there was to be the option of choosing between the two. I guess now the kind of cast has been, or the die has been cast, we'll take the 3 points in the league and say goodbye to the League Cup for this season.
Yeah, it's so often a kind of almost philosophical debate, because a cup win allows you to dream a little and there's this tangible silverware that feels within reach. But it's not, for me, it's not enough of a... I'm not coming away with a league victory going, but if it's kind of, I'll take either. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Particularly as the reward for winning at Old Trafford in the Cup would have been Newcastle at home, which would have been no easier task. Yeah. Dom, your thoughts on kind of this Cup versus league premise?
I understand it. And, you know, I loved winning at Manchester United back in 2012, was it?
2011.
Yeah.
That was within the context of a championship season, and then beating a Premier League team away, a decent one as well. But that, like, we beat the best team that Manchester United could put out at the weekend.
That's a very good point.
And we didn't do that in midweek, as in they didn't pick their strongest team in midweek. For the drama of it all, and I probably shouldn't say this, but the sort of crowing and the sort of sense of this is just going to be so easy, beating Palace again, and how our season's up and running. We've just hammered them in the cup. We'll beat them in the league. It's all just to shove that back down their throats with a 1-0 victory at the weekend was just fantastic.
Oh, and on that note, I don't know if you've seen Erik ten Hag's comments post-match, where he basically just states that Manchester United should be beating Crystal Palace home or away, whatever the scenario, maybe sums up why they're not in the place where they think they should be at the moment. Had a kind of air of Jurgen Klopp's fucking Crystal Palace comment, but maybe not to that degree. Dom, we'll move on. And again, this question came in before the news about Ebbs, but in relation to Odson Edouard missing out on Saturday and quite possibly missing out again this coming Saturday, I had a question about JP's performance on Saturday from Violent Bob 4. So I won't mess with him. So I'll just get on and ask your question, Bob, as quickly as I can. Is it time to start unironically loving Mateta? I thought Saturday was one of his best performances so far.
I think he's turning it around pretty impressively, to be honest, considering he was a player that really wanted to leave in the summer and felt a bit of a spare part, a player that we needed to upgrade. Look, don't get me wrong, I think Palace should have upgraded him, and I'm sure if they could have done, they would have done. But the reality is he is our only fit number nine, or only fit striker to lead the line of any note. He's actually, you know, when he turns it on, he's great to watch. He's great fun. And I love his instinctive finishing. It's just when he has time to think about it that's more of a problem. But you know, there are a lot of strikers that you can say that of. Look, at the moment we're relying on him, and we're all hoping that he can do the business at the weekend without a supply line, quite frankly. So, you know, long live JP.
Well, as host of this podcast and with those initials, I certainly will be taking it on this week, Dom. Much appreciated. Joe, I'll ask you to maybe throw some praise Jordan Ayew's way in just a moment, because Jean-Philippe Mateta was only second to Jordan Ayew in terms of presses in the final third. So I think that the role he has, not in terms of just that kind of focal point, as Dom touches on, he was also contributing to the press, which, you know, got us into certain parts of the pitch, and, you know, I think could be argued led to the free kick that led to the goal. So that type of press was paramount to us getting that result at the weekend. Jordan, I mean, week on week this season, we've been very, very not generous with our praise. But I think we've been honest with our praise for Jordan Ayew. But Saturday was another very solid turnout from Jordan, wasn't it?
I think even the most sort of cynical critics of Jordan Ayew at Palace in terms of what does he offer going forward, I think even they would admit that these are the exact sort of games you want Jordan Ayew around for. When we're backs against the wall and we need someone to win fouls up the pitch, he's I think quite by a distance the most foul player in the Premier League. And the sort of stat you would see as praiseworthy for Wilfried Zaha for several years, and he's never too far behind. And so it's kind of been highlighted a little bit more to my attention anyway. And the contrast between Amrabat's performance at left back with Jezrak Saki, which was very much a kind of welcome to the big leagues on that Wednesday night or Tuesday night. Well, certainly it felt like with the pat on the head and all that, which I quite enjoyed Raksaki's kind of refusal to play along. He just kind of get off me. But Ayew just returned the sort of lesson, really, in terms of like, I don't have to be a fullback that's going to go one-on-one with you and skin you. You might be able to deal with that. My job today is very different, and it's going to help my team out just as much. And I think both he and Mateta also, in terms of their work doing that, was such a big contributor to the result and the goal. I really enjoyed it. At halftime, I looked through the Sky Sports app, and their live commentary can be quite, you know, not too much information, depending on who's writing it, I guess.
A little but basic.
Yes, but I thought it was really telling. They said it was the third foul Amrabat had conceded on Ayew in the first half, and they said he's playing him like a violin. And I just thought that, like, for that to be said as a, from a neutral, I assume's perspective, just kind of showed what he really brought to that game. So yeah, I'm quite a loud fan of Jordan. That just added to the optimism and the delight I have in him and a fandom.
Yeah, it was a very well-won free kick, but if I was a United fan, I'd be asking what on earth Amrabat is doing making a challenge like that. I mean, you literally cannot be posing less of a threat to the goal when you are facing the dugout. I don't understand what Amrabat was doing, but hey, we've talked about the goal and what happened there. Fantastic. So we won't talk any more on that one. Let's move on to a man who we don't often talk about. We did touch on him last week, but Jaro Vidaveld has had quite a lot of love since last week. I think his performance in the League Cup was perhaps one of the better in that defeat. And then he came on and got minutes, I think the last 15 or 20 minutes or so on Saturday. And as you mentioned in part one, Joe, is being considered an option ahead of this weekend. So the questions predate the news about Ebbs, but Jamie Muller asked, does Jaro deserve a bigger role in the squad? And Vito the Dog, good to have you on board this week. Is Jaro working himself into a more prominent role? So Joe, I'll come to you on that one. And then Dom, if you want to come in on Jaro too, that'd be great.
Given the options available at the moment, he of course is in consideration, he has to be. I guess even if you go before Ebbs's injury, I think Jairo's selection in the midfield ahead of a Will Hughes, for example, which is probably what it would be, I suppose, or perhaps as a companion to Decore while in the absence of Lerma. I guess a home game against Nottingham Forest would be the sort of one where you might maybe consider him, because there's a with a fuller squad and in terms of injury free, which is now just completely fanciful, but you'd imagine Weir would be in a lot more possession in some of those games, certainly compared to the Old Trafford visit, for example. But what's really interesting is that he has shown himself to play really well in those games where we aren't having a lot of the ball. I would associate him as someone that you would want in a game where you're just kind of trying to unlock the opposition, because he's comfortable on the ball and is really good in tight spaces, I found, with the ball. But those skills are, as we've seen, quite applicable in these games where we're not going to have a lot of the ball. It still proves to be of great use. I guess there's probably other factors that need to be considered as to whether he should be going ahead of somebody else who the defensive instincts are a lot more kind of full-blooded, if you like. But I don't think he's going to let us down. But does it need to be more than that at this point? Or are we just he's a body without an injury at the moment? Is that's enough?
We'll take it. Dom, your thoughts on Jaro?
Well, I think he's fulfilling the role that he's got at the club. He's a squad player, and that means he's in every matchday squad pretty much. And when required, he gets called upon, and he may well be required from the start on Saturday, depending on what system Hodgson plays and how he accommodates for the reality that he's lost his most creative player. I mean, I don't think Jaro Vidaveld is going to unlock Nottingham Forest. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think he will. Well, that's not his game. But then there might be cause, as you say, to ask Jaro to sit in midfield and ask maybe Decore and Will Hughes to provide a bit of energy as sort of more, I don't know, enterprising number eights in a system, and have Vidaveld as a six and just sitting there. He could certainly distribute the ball well enough in that way. That might be a way of getting around it and sort of tweaking the system from a 4-2-3-1 to something more like a 4-3-3, possibly. But I mean, it's needs must, though, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing else. Jaro is a bit of a mystery. He's a cult figure who we all wanted to succeed at the beginning, but didn't, because he became a bit tainted with the Frank de Boer brush, unfortunately. Didn't really have a role to play in the sort of Hodgson revival. Then sort of came back into fashion, because we all know there's talent there. We can all see the talent when he has his cameos, and he's schooled in the Ajax way, etc. He's very comfortable in possession. But he sort of came back into fashion only really when Palace had a very, very stretched, tired, aging squad during a lockdown, which none of us want to remember fondly and none of us want to revisit. But actually, he was a bit of a breath of fresh air in there, occasional moments, occasional flashes of his quality. But as soon as Palace re-strengthened in 21, there was no room for him in the team. I mean, he wasn't close to getting in that team. Again, reduced to sort of cameos at left back occasionally, or cameos in the cups. And that's what we're at now. It hasn't changed. He's 27. He's played 80 odd games for Palace since 2017.
Is he 20? I was gonna look earlier to say how old he was, and I didn't have time, but 27.
Yeah.
And he's played less than 90 first team matches in what is nearly 7 years.
Yeah. I mean, I presume he's earned well, because he must be very frustrated with his this isn't the career path that he would have envisaged, I'm sure. But he started
a Europa League final in 2017. I think he started in that Ajax team that lost to Manchester United. So, I think he's one of those players. Dependable is how I would describe him, is that when he does come in, he doesn't let us down. He has got that tidiness on the ball. But for a player who didn't feature particularly prominently in pre-season to now be kind of not pinning hopes on, but as Joe kind of touches on, being a body, literally being fit is the criteria right now. And it is quite possible he will start. I'd imagine if he does start, it'll be a flatter midfield with, as you say, Dom, Will Hughes or Decore maybe pushing into advanced positions when they come. But Jeffrey Schluck may...
That's frustrating though, isn't it, Jack? I mean, it's...
Oh, very, very
when you see, I mean, we know that he's got the talent, but even in that United Cup game, there was one moment in the second half, I think it was, where he picked up the ball inside his own half and actually drove forward. And you think, blimey, he's actually got a bit of pace and a bit of the afterburner sort of kicked in. But I think that's probably the first time I've seen that in about 4 years.
Well, I'm glad you referenced that, because I think that it was this week that Mark Gay and Eberich Eze featured on Premier League Productions' kind of quiz feature about Palace, and they were asked who the fastest player at the club is, and I can't remember who answered who.
I think Mark put Schlupp,
Jeffrey Schlupp,
and Ebbs put Gyro.
There you go. And Gyro was named the fastest, and it did surprise me. But Gyro, as you say, has shown glimpses of that, and it could be that energy that we at least maybe get 60, 65 minutes out of him on Saturday. But we shall see where Roy goes with the Forest selection, and we'll come on to that in part four. Final question for this week, or perhaps it's a request. Dan Purvis, I know it's not strictly Palace this week, but can I request a Jack Pearce times Darren England rant trademark? Well, Dan, I haven't got that trademark yet, but if there is a market for this type of content, I will start a Cameo channel.
You've got to complete half of Merseyside for that.
Absolutely. look, I think Darren England's relationship with Palace fans is now well known, so there has been an element of Palace fans enjoying what happened over the weekend. But in all seriousness, absolutely shocking mistake. As we're recording on Tuesday, the audio from that incident has just been released. I've not heard it myself. Dom has. Dom, quick summary of the audio between Darren England and... Yeah, go on.
It's chaotic. It's very, very chaotic. The only person that seems to be talking sense is one of the video operators who sort of... At the bottom of it all, there's a misunderstanding because England is a misunderstanding over whether the goal has been given on field or not. Mm-hmm. So when they say check complete, go, 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 they think that the goal has been given and therefore it should be a kickoff. And they don't notice that the ball has just been placed and restarted with a free kick. And it's this poor little video operator that's going, Hold on, this isn't right. Can we stop this? delay. And by that moment, the moment's gone. But it's astonishing. It's an astonishing lesson because it gives you a real insight into what just seems like absolute chaos. And that's what the Premier League, that's what the PGMOL are now trying to mould into something slightly more manageable, which may well mean that we're going to get more delays again in games.
I was going to ask what maybe we should expect this Saturday, particularly with Saturday night's game being in the UK, kind of the featured Saturday night football game. I think it's fair to say that if that had been Palace on the wrong end of it, we would have spent this whole episode talking about it. And it's quite possible that Selzy would still be recording the post-match pod 72 hours later if it had been made at the expense of Palace. But
I wonder whether they would have released the audio for that, though.
Quite possibly. You do wonder whether the furore would have been quite the same if it had been not just Palace, but any club that maybe doesn't feature in the typical top six. But Dom, would you expect this incident to impact the way VAR is used? You just alluded to maybe reviews taking a bit longer, but can they change it between now and the end of the season in terms of how VAR is used? Or would that impact the integrity of the competition to kind of implement a change in terms of how VAR is used mid-season, even though it's only seven games in?
They have done it before, I guess, 7-8.
The handball thing with Joel Ward.
Yeah.
I think Liverpool might argue that the integrity of the competition has already been violated, to be honest. But look, they will do that. They'll instigate that. There'll be slightly longer checks, I'm sure. But one of the most interesting parts, other than the audio, of the statement that PGMOL released on Tuesday night was an admission that that their decision to allow referees to go off to other parts of the world and basically freelance as referees is also now under review. And I'm sure you would love to launch two-footed at that particular issue, Jack, because we shouldn't forget where Darren England and his video assistant referee were in midweek.
The UAE on a freelance gig, by all accounts, invited by the UAE FA, in a week when it's been kind of publicly made available that the Saudi FA are actively looking to recruit European referees for their league. So it's going to be interesting to see over the next few seasons what happens in terms of the, and I will use the term fraternity, the refereeing fraternity, as to whether the temptation of, but I guess bigger contracts, bigger offers for referees will tempt them to leave their domestic leagues and seek passage new. I mean, after retirement, Mark Clattenburg, sorry, listener, I should have given you warning, I was going to mention him, but Mark Clattenburg went and refereed in the Middle East. But to see referees do it perhaps mid-career compared to kind of post-retiring at that top level would add a different element to it. And you'd start to see, I guess, referees linked with moves away from leagues like players currently are, which does seem completely bonkers. But when that news came out that Darren England had been, you know, travelling, and it's only a 6 or 7 hour flight, but only 6 or 7 hour flights before being part of the officiating team for the flagship match in the most watched domestic league in the world, just seems a bit bonkers to me. And I'm sure the PGML wanted to address it, but how do you address that when, you know, the cat's out of the bag in the sense that the mistake's been made? It will be interesting. Joe, your thoughts on that particular incident and maybe what you think might be coming in terms of the VAR use between now and the end of the season?
I don't know how feasible it is short term, but I've got a feeling that the idea of audio being released, it may becomes more frequent. It may become a standard of, you know, an hour after games or a particular time. But part of me does wonder, I think there's a lot of people who say, oh, it would just be common sense if a referee came out after the game and explained their decision, or we heard the audio. And really, I don't think that would really make anyone any more happy. I think it would just, they would still be annoyed about it. They would still find a way to be angry and moan. The UAE, the emergence of that trip was really kind of unhelpful timing. It just, all the conspirators and the rabid Liverpool fan base crying, oh, it therefore must mean this, just wasn't, really didn't help anybody in the, as the story kind of developed. I don't know. I'm still pro VAR and it applied right and everything. But something like that's just head in hands for everybody.
They probably could have done, you know, you mentioned the Darren England bit again, but they probably could have done without Johan Visser not having a penalty awarded literally a day later. I mean, it's just shining a light on the worst of it when there is so much positive that can come from VAR. I think the profile of the two clubs involved on Saturday and the fact it was the game that it was has just exacerbated the noise around this story. But to see Stephen Warnock on Sky Sports News yesterday nearly in tears at what is an injustice. It's not perceived. It's there for us all to see. But there is so much feeling about this. I do wonder whether on Saturday, for a game that's due to finish at 7:15, 7:20, I do wonder, given VAR checks, whether it might be close to 8 o'clock by the time we get out on Saturday, just to make sure they don't make the errors they've made this time around. But hey, we'll see. I'm sure we'll be talking about VAR again as the season progresses. But I suggest we might not be seeing Darren England particularly soon. But we shall see. We shall see. Everyone, thanks so much for your questions. Dom and Joe, thanks for your answers there. Listener, appreciate we didn't get through all of the questions, but always very grateful to those that do send them in. So please do keep sending them in as the weeks go by. Next up is this week's 3-2-1. Welcome back to the third part of this week's FYP podcast, sponsored by Greene King Sport, where football is more than a game. Before we get into this week's 3-2-1, just a quick nod to October's episode in this season's interview series. I won't spoil the surprise as to who it is, but it will be released to patrons on the Wednesday of this week, which I think is the 4th, and to everyone else on Friday, which will be the 6th of October. Okay, on with 3-2-1. Dom, your first go at this, I think. So quick summary of the idea. We each nominate our Palace Player of the Week and then agree who to allocate the 1, the 2, and the 3 points to. Those points are then added to JD's master spreadsheet, which will be used to determine the FYP Player of the Season come May. As of last week's episode, the early pace setter is Jean-Philippe Mateta. That's quite the pace setter, Jean-Philippe Mateta, who leads the field with 5 points. Let's see if that changes after today. So, Dom, your nominee for 3-2-1.
So just to clarify, it has to be a player?
Well, I think the season started and JD was like, it can be anyone. but I think as the week's gone on, I think we've kind of evolved this into a player of the season type competition. But if you wanted to contribute anyone, we'll see if they garner points as the season goes. And if the away fans win the player of the season, the away fans win the player of the season. I'll let JD kind of determine who wins what. I'm just here to facilitate this week. So you chuck at me whoever you want, Dom.
Well, look, I'll say Roy Hodgson just because, no one gave them a hope going to Old Trafford for the second time in 4 days with so few resources really at his disposal. And United sort of feeling as if they turned a corner. And for him to extend that unbeaten run at Old Trafford is something else, really. And to do it with such a tight and well-drilled game plan that just, okay, it required a moment of brilliance from a person who's now inevitably not going to get nominated. But it required that moment of magic. But Palace had to stay in the match. They had to nullify. They had to frustrate. They had to leave United completely exasperated, and that's exactly what they did because they were so brilliantly drilled. And of all the videos that were released by Palace on Saturday night, my favourite by a mile was Ray Lewington just punching the air and just looking like he couldn't really believe what had just happened. And, this is a man that thought he'd given up football maybe 2 years ago. And there he was winning at Old Trafford in the rain. Just magnificent. So I'll give it to Roy with a little nod to Ray as well.
Lovely. Yeah, I think the images of Ray Lewington dancing in the rain were quite something. And it's quite incredible that, you're dealing with a club the size of Manchester United. And as you say, Dom, two guys who have probably left top class football behind a couple of times now, or at least thought they were, have masterminded a victory against a club the size of Manchester United, against a manager with the profile of Erik ten Hag, who, towards the end of last season was being determined as the most appropriate manager at Manchester United since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. Like, it is just fantastic that Roy Hodgson is guiding us with the raft of injuries that is impacting his ability to choose his best team. It is quite incredible, to be honest. Joe, your thoughts on Roy just after the first 7 games of the season? And Ray, bring it round. Have all of it.
Well, I guess from this side, I've always assumed the appointment of Paddy McCarthy as assistant rather than Ray was an idea of succession planning, however realistic that is in top level football. But if it was any other reason about maybe, Ray not being so sure if he's up to it anymore, I'm so glad he is still in the setup because he evidently has such a lift to the dugout, if not the players on the pitch. And I find him a really kind of enjoyable figure. And you've got to think this is his third spell at Palace now, right? He was around that sort of Dave Bassett era as well, right? Then Koppel.
He started pretty much as the manager in 95, 96.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, we hear a lot of talk of Hodgson as a Mr. Crystal Palace and as a Palace fan. Ray's allegiances may lie elsewhere in terms of who he supports, but it kind of applies in the same way. It's just not really thought about as often. And the way the situation and the season's emerging, symbolically, I was with a lot of people back in the spring of thinking, is this really the right idea? Is this what we want? I'm so glad they're both in charge. And I also bemoan them not being given a fair crack in terms of the players and you know, if I, being super captain hindsight, I do wonder how we would have fared in 2021-22 with that same bunch of players in, and them in charge. I think I had a feeling we'd have closed out a lot more of those games in that first half of the season. But it's all, I mean, it's all ancient history now. But I love them so much, and I'm just, I wish they would take some credit. I wish they would take some credit as well. I guess it's just Roy as a classy operator. He will not, he will always give it back to, put it back on the players after a performance like that. And, you know, I hope he does know that he's appreciated for his efforts in that too.
Yeah, I really hope he does. I'm sure the messages are getting through. I mean, just from the support that he'll see at Selhurst, that there's so much support behind him. And I don't think there can be many fans who are thinking that the lack of squad depth is really anything to do with him. You know, I think that there is an acceptance that this was a one-year arrangement, an extension of that 10 games that he had at the end of last season, and that the recruitment was maybe separate to Roy coming. Dom, you may know differently, but I just think Roy would have just taken whichever hand he was given. He was given a bit of a soft hand to play with in terms of squad depth. It didn't take too much to see the kind of limitations of the squad at the moment. So, but he's making the best of it. He's just coordinated a win at Old Trafford, and yeah, great shout, Dom. Joe, your nominee this week.
I want to show some more love to Joel Ward. I think the last time we were on together, there was a big question after. Oh God, what game was it now? Where he had another game where it wasn't great.
Was it Villa?
It was Villa, which follow it, and obviously the Brentford trip. There was their goal. He was heavily culpable in that. And, you know, that invited some criticism and the questions and more of a spotlight on that position in the pitch. But I think the last week, both in his absence and by him starting, has shown why he is the starting right back for Palace when everyone is fit. Maybe that's harsh on Nathaniel Clyne, but I didn't see a lot in that midweek game. That it was, if that was the audition, I'm sorry, we're not calling you back. And I, you know... Joel Ward is the starting right back. That's the way it is. It's the way it's going to be probably beyond January. I saw Nathan Ferguson. Sorry, you know, don't want to put any pressure on him. I saw that he played in the week for 10-20 minutes at centre half again. Oh,
did he get minutes? I saw he was on the bench. He got minutes.
Yeah, he came on in the second half.
Okay, interesting.
But I think most people are not. Well, I'm not one to. I don't really want to look to him too much as a, well, he'll be back soon, because that's just, I think it's just so much more complex with him. And so I just think to then put in a performance like he did on the weekend as skipper, I'm really happy for him when he has games like that, because I think he's on a hiding to nothing really, from certain sections of the support, as somebody who is pretty much the only real option we've got there, bar some kind of speculative ones that people keep suggesting, which I think if Chris Richards was a natural right back, I think we'd have seen it a long time ago. So just, you've got to support him and back him, and he'll turn out performances like that every now and then.
Yeah, he did have a solid game. I mean, the whole back line was incredibly solid, and, you know, maybe a special mention to Tyree Mitchell, who I won't be nominating, but I think is worth a mention as well, because he had probably his best game of the season too. Really pleased to see Joel have a good game. As you say, I think Nathaniel Clyne's performance in the League Cup, love Nathaniel as I do, probably did indicate why Joel Ward is the first choice right now, and, you know, will be until injury or suspension or a replacement, says Lister. Yeah. But I think, Joel will be the right back until January at the very earliest. And as you say, Joe, quite possibly until next summer.
You mentioned the Ebbs and Mark Gay, almost like a Mr. and Mrs. of the squad on, I think it was Amazon Prime's content. Some other stuff in that I think is worth mentioning, just that you can take as much or little as you want from it. The player that eats the most food was Nathaniel Clyne, I think, was revealed. And I think they nicknamed him Takeaway Man.
Yeah, Mr. Takeaway or something like that.
Which I thought, core, that's not a reputation you want as the backup defender. That doesn't suggest someone that's really going, busting a gut to make a... place, they'll make a claim for a place in the side. Yes,
maybe he is.
Yes, maybe, yeah, yeah. When you compare it to some of the other stuff, also, I thought was telling. JP was the funniest player in the squad.
He's adored. He's absolutely adored JP.
Yeah.
Which, the players love him.
Yeah. Which, and we're starting to see that this season, I think, in terms of even when he's coming off the bench, he's doing all that, waving his arms to the lift, trying to lift the crowd, smiling. And so stuff like that, it does matter. And like someone else you mentioned, I think they said IU was the strongest. It wasn't even, I think they both agreed on that yeah. together, yeah. which helps contribute to results that we got. So, but yeah, back to, yeah, Joel Ward. That's my
he's your nominee this week. I think given the Dom, anything to add on Joel Ward? We've probably said it all before about Joel, in that when he's called upon, he will be dependable. He has got his limitations. We all know that. He cost £400,000 from Portsmouth 5,000 years ago. Like, you know, what is there to say about Joel Ward that we've not said?
No, you're spot on. I mean, when he puts in performances like that, you just marvel at it, don't you? But I'd echo your comments on Tariq Mitchell as well, because I thought he had a really difficult game on Tuesday night, and then to recover and play like he did at the weekend is a testament to his character, really.
And earned the sleep that Remy Matthews documented on his Instagram as well. So if you've not seen that, look out for it, because it did make echoes of Declan Rice on holiday with Mason Mount, but perhaps not to the extremities of that one. I don't think we cannot nominate Joachim Andersen, so I will put our great Dane forward, given the praise that we offered him in the first part. There's not much more to add on that. So if you want more Andersen adulation, then I dare say, listener, rewind and start the podcast again, because there was a fair bit in the first part. But yeah, going from strength to strength, and the two centre halves. I think it's fair to say given current absences, the strongest part of the team, perhaps with competition with Sam Johnson, who again deserves an honourable mention, had another good performance, and for a former Manchester United player, I'm sure delighted to come away with the 3 points. So Dom, it's at this point that we now kind of decide who gets the 3 points, who gets the two, and who gets the one. So contenders are Roy Hodgson and Ray Lewington. Joel Ward is nominated by Joe, and Joachim Andersen as nominated by myself. So anyone stand out for the three?
Having introduced the idea that Roy and Ray should be in this list, I think this week we have, I think, maximum points.
Fair enough.
Because I think we've maybe shied away from it in the previous instances of this game.
Yeah.
And actually, I think, no, let's do it. Let's give them their props.
We'll have to nominate him next week as well if they get a result against them, given what they've got to pick.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, given the cards he's been dealt with. And I think in light of becoming that first opposing manager to go 5 unbeaten at Old Trafford, which is no mean feat, I think you're right. I think we should go 3 points for Roy Hodgson. Given Anderson's performance on Saturday, are we then okay to give him the two and give Joel the solitary one? Is that fair? Okay. I dare say, and without looking at the numbers...
face is not...
No, I'm fine. I am fine. I'm just here to facilitate. I love it. I think I give Roy everything. There was another question this week as to whether we need to start a campaign to get the man knighted. And I would agree with Selzy that the freedom of Croydon is worth more than any sort of royal accolade. But anyway, that's a different story. Without the numbers in front of me, I dare say we go by another week with Jean-Philippe Mateta top of the charts. But, we'll have to get JD to confirm that when he's next hosting. Thank you, everyone. That's the end of part three. And join us after break for a quick preview of Saturday's fixture at home to Steve Cooper's Nottingham Forest. Welcome back to the final part of this week's FYP podcast, sponsored by Green King Sports. Nottingham Forest visits Selhurst this weekend. Dom, what did you make of Forest's trolley dash on transfer deadline day, and who do you consider poses the biggest threat to Palace this coming weekend?
Well, we all thought that Forest had a relatively calm and sensible transfer window, really, until the events of the last 24 hours of the window, and they just went, as you say, this went absolutely insane. It was a revisiting the summer of 22. Just a ridiculous number of players came in at really good prices as well, some of whom were probably will prove real upgrades on what they had already. Others will probably never see.
I mean, Ibrahim Sangara is the one that caught the eye most of all as a club record signing, about £30 million. A player that Palace looked at extensively in the past, never really had the funds to pursue it with PSV Eindhoven. And for them to convince him to come there after PSV have qualified for the Champions League was quite something. I think he's having a bit of a slowish start, but there was slightly more influence. He exerted slightly more influence against Brentford at the weekend. So he will be a threat, and he's very much in that sort of Palinha role. I thought Palinha was excellent at Palace when he came with Fulham a couple of weeks back, and I think we'll see something approaching that from Sangara. But they've got, you know, they made some decent ones. They got a relative bargain in Hudson-Odoi, as you mentioned. Dominguez, I think he's got carrying a knock for, he might not be available this weekend. We might actually see a young loanee from Chelsea, Andre Santos, making his first appearance in the league. He's only played in the League Cup, I think, for them so far. But again, a player of talent, but untried at this level. So, but this is why I look at it and think that would be normally an opportunity to have a go at these guys. But I suspect they'll be better organised than we give them credit for, and I think it'll be a proper test now.
They did well to grab a point with 10 men on Saturday.
Yeah.
Sunday. And it was Dominguez who I think grabbed the equaliser.
That's right.
And you think he's a doubt for this weekend?
Yeah, he went off injured later on in that game. Looks as if it was a hamstring problem again. So, I mean, he's a player that's adapting to life in a new league. And you know that will be a blow for them. But then they've got people who are like Divock Origi who can come in, who haven't played very much in the league for them. They've got a lot. I mean, they've got new signings up and down the team. Like, look at the goalkeeping situation. You know, they spent most of the summer umming and ahhing as to whether they were going to go back in for Dean Henderson, and ended up signing Matt Turner from Arsenal, who has had his moments, but he's also looks shaky at other times as well. So it's a keeper that you want to test. And Hudson-Odoi has shown flashes. He scored a great goal in one of his early games for them, possibly his debut.
Yeah, but against Burnley.
Against Burnley, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful goal. Showed his talent, showcased it. And I know that he was a player that a lot of Palace fans wanted to get because you looked at the price that they paid for him, you know, £2 or 3 million, it's a bargain. But the reality is you have to take into account the wages as well. And he was on massive money at Chelsea because he had been courted by Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund and clubs like that a few years back. And they'd given him a contract under the previous regime that would have established him safely as Palace's leading highest wage earner if he moved on similar terms to Salah. So I'm not sure that was ever really an option.
Yeah, a low transfer fee of around
2 or 3 million. It was
something, but peanuts, wasn't it? Yeah. I get this to keep the chat on Callum Hudson-Odoi, actually, Joe, a player that many Palace fans wanted us to pursue, as Dom said, and you know, in terms of the relatively low transfer fee that was being kind of bounded around, but as Dom says, the wages would have proved a significant obstacle. Do you rate Callum Hudson-Odoi? And if you do say no, do you also accept responsibility for his late winner this week?
Well, it'd be safer I say I do rate him as a player. Then let's just
get that out of there.
Keep that at bay. But and it's a very exciting player, spoken up as one of kind of the most exciting prospects, young English prospects when he was younger. I don't think he has, you know, there's some injuries that have gone in between there. Perhaps that kept some bigger clubs from biting on that opportunity. I thought the cries for him to come to Palace, in hindsight, obviously, it would be really handy to have him now, but the messages, any kind of whispers that came out of Palace, the messages seemed quite consistent that he was just not being considered seriously. So I don't know how much I see that as an opportunity loss when, as Dom says, I imagine he was on, even if reduced, quite significant, very significant wages. And I know, yes, that the Dean Henderson wages have supposedly been circulating, and that's kicked off, started another conversation. But I feel like Hudson-Odoi went to Forest of all teams for a reason. Mm-hmm. I think you look at Jesse Lingard going there last time out as a sort of parallel thing. I think they're offering very generous terms to millions of players. It's funny, I thought they would have learned their lesson from last time out. You know, they broke our record when we were promoted last summer for transfers in one window, and we learned our lesson.
Comfortably, I think they beat our record.
Yes, and you know, we learned our lesson from that. You know, we kind of said we made big mistakes as a club, and we're not going to do that again, and we didn't. But Forest just seemed to. It's like they're excited to be called up. It's like the agents are really, you know, flicking their eyelashes. I'm mumbling my words there, but just they're fluttering their eyelashes at the owner, and he's all over. He's like, "Yeah, look, I'll buy you dinner. I'll sign the player for however much you want." And yet still, towards the back end of last season, there were moments where they had Jack Colbeck and Jonjo Shelvey starting in midfield together. That's Steve McLaren's Newcastle midfield. And you think, how have you spent all that money and got that card and still going into games looking like that? And yeah, here they are again. I think Gibbs White is somebody that they've got game changers. Yes, there are some names that have not quite made it at other clubs or might be expensive mercenaries if you want to be unkind, but they've Gibbs got White. A big squad there.
Yeah, Gibbs White is one who I didn't catch the whole of the game on Sunday.
There was a suggestion that he was rested towards the end of that.
I don't know what the situation was, but Steve Cooper had to kind of insist that he hadn't been dropped. It was more of a case of perhaps managing an injury. He's played a lot of football. You know, he played the tournament in the summer. I think he came back almost immediately back to Forest's pre-season. And as you say, Dom, earlier on in the pod, like, this is the time of year where players do pick up injuries. So for a player of that importance to Forest, it's right, and with the bountiful options he has available to him, he can manage his minutes probably a little bit better than Roy could manage some of our players' minutes at the moment. So it's an interesting one. And they are also dealing with the departure of Brennan Johnson, who I guess was considered their talisman last year. So it's, you know, despite being a second season in the Premier League, it could almost be considered the first season again, given the turnover of players they've gone through again and the loss of such a key figure as Johnson. So we'll see what happens on Saturday. Intrigued to see what Roy does. It'll be very interesting to see if any players do return. I guess there could be hope that Jefferson Lerma might return, but as Dom said earlier on, you may not be looking to risk players just before an international break. And if Jefferson Lerma returns for his club, I dare say he might then have to fly out to South America for some international fixtures with Colombia. So we shall see who does feature for Palace on Saturday. But guys, thanks so much for joining this week. I think we'll let JD, who's in the chair next week, get into the weeds as to what happens on Saturday. And we won't preempt anything that does occur because we've had so much to talk about so far. So guys, thanks so much for joining this week. Patrons, you'll get a post-match pod after the Forest game. If you aren't a patron and would like to join for such perks, please visit patreon.com/FYP podcast. Listeners, thanks for joining this week. Hope your week goes well. And here's to going into the international break with back-to-back wins. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.